स्वामी प्रभुपारनंदे आगवेश आगवेश श्री श्री गुरु गौराम
नमः भगवते वासुदेवाय
Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 10. Bhagavatam is the answer to all questions. This is the last chapter in this canto. Texts 1 through 3 we're doing today. Text 1, word meanings. Sri Shuka Uvacha, Sri Shukadeva Goswami said, Atra, in this Srimad Bhagavatam, Sarga, statement of the creation of the universe, Visarga, statement of subcreation, Cha, also, Sthanam, the planetary systems, Poshanam, protection, Utayaha, the creative impetus, Manvantara, changes of Manus, Isha Anukata, science of God, Nirodha, going back home, back to Godhead, Muktihi, liberation, Ashraya, the summum bonum. Sri Shuka Uvacha, Atra Sargo Visargascha, Sthanam Poshanam Utaya, Manvantare Shanukata, Nirodho Muktirashraya, Sri Shuka Uvacha, Atra Sargo Visargascha, Sthanam Poshanam Utaya, Manvantare Shanukata, Nirodho Muktirashraya, Sri Shuka Uvacha, Atra Sargo Visargascha, Sthanam Poshanam Utaya, Manvantare Shanukata, Nirodho Muktirashraya.
Amen.
Translation. Sri Shukadeva Goswami said, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, there are 10 divisions of statements regarding the following: the creation of the universe, sub-creation, planetary systems, protection by the Lord, the creative impetus, the change of manus, the science of God, returning back home, back to Godhead, liberation, and the summum bonum. Text 2. Dashamasya vishuddhyartam navanam ihalakshanam varnayanti mahatmanah yutanarkena chandrasa. To isolate the transcendence of the summum bonum, the symptoms of the rest are described, sometimes by Vedic inference, sometimes by direct explanation, and sometimes by summary explanations given by the great sages. Bhuta matrendriya dhiyam janma sarga udarita brahmano guna vaishunya isarga purusha smita. The elementary creation of 16 items of matter, namely the five elements, fire, water, land, air, and sky, sound, form, taste, smell, touch, and the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, skin, and mind, is known as sarga, whereas subsequent resultant interaction of the modes of material nature is called visarga. Srila Prabhupada's purport. In order to explain the 10 divisional symptoms of the Srimad Bhagavatam, there are 7 continuous verses. The first of these under reference pertains to the 16 elementary manifestations of earth, water, etc., with material ego composed of material intelligence and mind. The subsequent creation is a result of the reactions of the above-mentioned 16 energies of the first Purusha, the Mahavishnu incarnation of Govinda, as later explained by Brahma in his treatise Brahma Samhita 547 as follows. Ya karanarna vajale bhajati smayoga nidramananta jagaranda saronakupa Ādhāra Shaktim Avalamya Param Samurtim Govinda Māri Purusham Tamaham Bhajami. The first Purusha incarnation of Govinda, Lord Krishna, known as Mahavishnu, goes into a yoga nidra mystic sleep, and the innumerable universes are situated in potency in each and every hair hole of his transcendental body. As mentioned in the previous verse, Shrutena, or with reference to the Vedic conclusions, the creation is made possible from the Supreme Personality of Godhead directly by manifestation of his particular energies. Without such a Vedic reference, the creation appears to be a product of material nature. This conclusion comes from a poor fund of knowledge. From Vedic reference, it is concluded that the origin of all energies, namely internal, external, and marginal, is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And as explained here and before, the illusory conclusion is that creation is made by the inert material nature. The Vedic conclusion is transcendental light, whereas the non-Vedic conclusion is material darkness. The internal potency of the Supreme Lord is identical with the Supreme Lord, and the external potency is enlivened in contact with the internal potency. The parts and parcels of the internal potency which react in contact with the external potency are called the marginal potency or the living entities. Thus, the original creation is directly from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, or Param Brahman. and the secondary creation as a reactionary result of the original ingredients is made by Brahma. Thus the activities of the whole universe are started. Om jnana kimirandhasya jnananjana shalakaya chakshurun miditamena tasmai sri guruve namaha. The last chapter, we get the four nutshell verses of the Bhagavatam. Then after that, there's some discussion of what took place after that. It says, on the disappearance of the Supreme Personality of Godhead Hari, who is the object of transcendental enjoyment for the senses of devotees, Brahma with folded hands began to recreate the universe full of living entities as it was previously. So there's a few verses. Then that Narada is mentioned. He approached his father to inquire from him, and his father spoke again the Srimad Bhagavatam. He spoke what he heard in his own words, or expanded on it. Prabhupada gives a very nice purport explaining this principle, how one hears in the Parampara system, one can expand what one has heard according to one's own realizations, without any speculation, of course. So what Brahma spoke, we actually heard earlier in this canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, in earlier chapters. Brahma's instructions to Narada, those are also considered a retelling of the Srimad Bhagavatam. We have the original four verses, then we have a second speaking of the Bhagavatam in 100 something, I forget what the number is, 150, 170, somewhere in that range of verses that Lord Brahma spoke in previous chapters. So in the context of saying that, explaining that point, then we have this verse, text 44, the last chapter. Thereupon, so this is referring to Brahma speaking to Narada, thereupon, the supplementary Vedic literature of Srimad Bhagavatam, which was described by the Personality of Godhead, and which contains 10 characteristics, was told with satisfaction by the father, Brahma, to his son, Narada. So that's why we're getting these 10 characteristics now. Sukadeva Goswami is explaining what these were described. Dasha Lakshanam, 10 characteristics. So lakshana, again, lakshana means characteristics. When you want to understand something, you understand it by its characteristics or its qualities. That's what makes a thing what it is. And there's actually two types of these lakshanam. There's a sarup lakshana and a tatashka lakshana. So sarup lakshana is what the thing is in essence. And just before Krishna spoke the nutshell verses, there were some introductory verses where Krishna said that he was going to reveal in text 31 and 32 of the previous chapter. And the second, text 32, he said, all of me, namely my actual eternal form and my transcendental existence, color, qualities, and activities. So you could say these, especially this, it's Krishna's eternal form and transcendental existence. This is his sarup. This is Bhagavan. This is who Krishna is. But then, of course, as Prabhupada is pointing out in his purport today, everything is connected to Krishna. So everything else is Krishna's energy. So the characteristics are these are the tatashta shakti, what Krishna does, and everything related to him. These are the tatashta lakshana, these secondary characteristics. So we're hearing these first 10. And then the explanation is we hear 9 because we ultimately want to understand the 10th. In other words, we want to understand Krishna. So we learn about Krishna by hearing about his tatashta characteristics, tatashta lakshana, his marginal characteristics, you can say. And then later, once we've understood all of these to some extent, then we get to the 10th canto and we hear about Swayam Bhagavan more directly. Of course, he has appeared already here and there throughout the Bhagavatam, Krishna makes his appearances. In fact, just right from the beginning, in the seventh chapter of the first canto, where we start after Narada and Vyasadeva's meeting, then the Bhagavatam recitation, narration, you might say, begins after the battle of Kurukshetra, with the Ashwatthama, bringing out, sending forth the Brahmastra weapon to destroy the Pandavas. So then Krishna, of course, is there on this. Krishna's there, right, in that opening scene, you can say, in the Bhagavatam. So we don't necessarily have to wait all the way to the 10th canto to hear about Krishna. We hear about him here and there. But generally, this is the idea. The first nine cantos talk about these other nine characteristics that are described here. And then 10th canto, we hear about Krishna more directly. So let me just review these again. Actually, I was thinking of bringing other translations. Because one thing I wanted to mention was in the Tapasandarbha, Jiva Goswami, of course, the first part of the Tapasandarbha is the Pramana, where Jiva Goswami establishes how he's going to speak about Tattva. Of course, what is Tattva? Tattva is the Supreme Absolute Truth. So he's going to explain the Gaudiya Vaishnava understanding of Tattva, what is the Supreme Tattva, by referring to the Bhagavatam. Of course, he traces, of course, he works his way up to the Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam is our primary pramana. That's how we get our evidence about what is the absolute truth. And then the second part of the Tapasandarbha is called the Prameya, where he starts giving some of those instructions, what we hear about the absolute truth. He quotes the Vedanti Tattva Vida verse and speaks on that. And then he also quotes these 10 topics of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And we're going to speak, Jiva Goswami is going to speak about the absolute truth. So how is he going to do it? Well, this is one way he's going to do it, by referring to these topics, 10 topics of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Because, again, Jiva Goswami has made the point that the Srimad Bhagavatam clearly defines and reveals what is that absolute truth. So these 10 characteristics are subordinate to him. This is it's a rhetorical device or a tactic, a way of teaching, pedagogical way, how to present the subject that he wants to talk about. So he wants to do it by, first I'll describe some of the potencies of the absolute truth, then I'll speak about him more directly. So this is his list. Now, also this list, as Jiva Goswami mentions in the Tapasandarbha, these 10 are what are considered to be the characteristics of a Mahapurana. We have two categories of Puranas. So the great Puranas, they discuss 10 categories of Tattva, 10 different kinds of truths. So these are generally considered. They appear somewhat differently in other places, but these 10 are generally given as a greater Purana, and the lesser Puranas have 5 topics. Now this list also appears in the 12th canto. I think it was chapter it is, but it's maybe chapter 3. It's basically the same. Some of the wording is slightly different, but it's basically the same. So we have this list of these 10 subjects in 2 places. So let's go through them again here. So the 10 divisions, so we have Sarga. Sarga is called the creation, the primary creation. That means the creation of 16 elements. We often hear how Krishna creates the elements, or the stuff that Brahma is going to use, and then Brahma uses the material to do all the what he's going to do, the Visarga. So what are these 16? So they're described here. That's in the third verse. One thing is, I also want to mention, so we have this list of these 10, and then there's just one line, or maybe 2 lines, in the upcoming verses up through text number 7 that explains each one of them very briefly. You may be familiar, for example, with this, Is it past 7? Yeah, no, after 7. Where mukti, bhukti hritanya tarupam swarupena vivastiti, something Prabhupada would quote often. What do we think of as liberation? Liberation is when you get your actual form. It's not just merging into Brahman, but mukti is swarup, when you get your swarup, realize your swarup. So that's one of the lines, because mukti is one of the things in this list of 10. So it's briefly defined with this one line in this section, these opening verses of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So first we have sarga, which is a creation of the 16 elements. So the 16 elements are the 5 bhutas, the panchabhuta, which is earth, water, fire, air, and ether. So these are the first thing, these elements. And then we have the senses. What we usually refer to as knowledge acquiring senses, or the cognitive senses. These come next. Hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting. What's the other one? Are they listed here? Hearing, seeing, smelling, touching, and tasting. Sorry, touching. Yeah. Those are the next 5. And then the other 5 are the objects of the senses. So the working senses are not mentioned here. They come later to give us 20. Then mind, intelligence, false ego brings you up to 23. It's an easy way to remember if you're trying to remember what the 23 elements of the material nature are. Then there's 4 groups of 5. You have the knowledge acquiring senses, you have the working senses, you have the sense objects, and you have the 5 constituents of matter. So there you get 20 right there, these 4 groups of 5. Then you have mind, intelligence, and false ego. And the 24th, sometimes it said mahatattva, sometimes it said chitta. Chitta is, the subtle body is also includes chitta, which we don't often mention, but it comes up in Kapiladeva's teachings. Which is usually translated as simply as the material conception. When the jiva, it's the most subtle of the jiva's connections with the material energy. So these 24 are there. So this is sarga, the creation of that sarga. Then visarga is what Lord Brahma does. He creates all the planetary systems and he creates all the living entities. Of course, he does it, it's kind of unfolded. There's an evolution, you can say, that goes on. Because we hear in the Bhagavatam how different creatures are created by different descendants. The Prajapatis, Brahma creates Prajapatis from different parts of his body. That's part of it anyway. And then they create in different ways. So this is all part of Visarga. And it's also said that that Visarga is the mixing of the modes of material nature. When the modes of material nature are agitated, that's when Visarga takes place. Otherwise, all of these elements created by Krishna, or really Mahavishnu, they're lying dormant. They're inactive, they're in equilibrium. So they had to be stirred up somehow. So that's also called visarga. Of course, this prefix V, the word V means special in some way. It's like vishesha is the Sanskrit. For example, we have vijnana, which means a certain kind of jnana, means realized jnana. We have vimudha, a special kind of mudha. A real intense mudha. So V is an intensifier or qualifier, specializer. Or Krishna's beauty is called Vishesha Shobham, unique loveliness. So uniqueness, particularity, these things. That's the idea of this suffix, prefix V. So we have Sarga, then Visarga, a special kind of creation, what Lord Brahma does with all the varieties. So this takes place when the first things, these constituents of the material world are agitated by the 3 modes of material nature. That may come up later in the definition. of Visarga. So then the next one is Sthanam, which Prabhupada translates here as a planetary system. So Sthana, of course, the word Sthana is about something being fixed. So you have the fixed planetary systems on which things can take place. So much can unfold when the planetary systems are created. Actually, this word, this syllable, phoneme, stuff. You can think of so many words we have in English. Stick and stasis and stationary and all these ST verses, words that we have in English. They all come from this stuff sound, which in Sanskrit also, there are many words that have sta. They all have to do with the same idea, being stuck, you know, stationary, and so on. So the planetary systems are sta. The next is Poshanam. Poshanam means protection. And it especially means protection of the Lord's devotees by the Lord. Jiva Goswami explains in his Sundarbhas that Krishna really has only one thing to do, and that's to please his devotees. Krishna is the greatest of everything, so he's also the greatest servant. No one can serve someone else better than Krishna can. It's said that Krishna's bhakta vatsalya, his love for his devotees, is his greatest characteristic. We're talking about lakshana, characteristics of God. So this is his greatest characteristic. As Lord Vishnu tells Durvasa Muni, I'm completely under the control of my devotees. I have no independence, he says. This is considered to be his greatest. Although he's the supreme Ishvara, Parameshwar, he's in control of everything, because I'm in control by the love of my devotees. So this idea of Poshanam, again, Jiva Goswami brings this out in his Sundarbhas, that what Krishna really does, we hear about how Krishna is, you know, why is this creation here for the benefit of the living entities, you know, so they can ultimately go back to Godhead, they can reform themselves. Or it's also here to so that they can try to satisfy their desires in imitation of Krishna. But it's really, Jiva Goswami says, it's really about Krishna making a situation for those jivas who have already begun their journey back to Godhead, their awakening of prema, but they haven't quite completed. Krishna creates the material world so they can complete their journey back to him. That's you can say, the most subtle aspect of this idea of protection by the Lord. And one of the topics of the Bhagavatam. Of course, this comes out in the Bhagavatam many places, where Krishna, of course, he's also protecting his devotees in a more outward way. For example, how he protected Gajendra, protected Prahlad Maharaj. So that's part of it. That's also part of this idea. So the next of the 10 subjects of the Bhagavatam is Utaya. Utaya, Prabhupada translates here as creative impetus. What that means is what's in the heart of the jiva, their desires, unfulfilled desires. That's what makes everything happen. Sometimes it says that the jivas create the material world, because it's because of their desires that the material world exists. Krishna doesn't need it. It's because of their desires. So that impetus that they have, when they're dormant at the time of the annihilation, they enter into the body of the Lord, and their desires are still there, and their karma is still there in a dormant state. And then when the creation begins again, when it's brought back to life, then these things reawaken. And then the living entities go about their business, doing things in this, creating in this material world. Just like Prabhupada would often point out, like the people came to America from Europe, and it was really not developed at all, but now you see so many skyscrapers and so on because of that desire within them. So that happens all over the material world. The jivas have these desires, and they create so many things throughout the universe. So this is Utaya, the creative impetus. The next is Manvantar. Manvantar literally means the change of manus. And this is explained to be actually a way of saying that the topic is really about dharma, because this is what the manus are about. Manu means thinker, by the way. Manu, because it's related to the mind, manu. And manusya, which is the word for human beings, that means also thinkers. Because animals have so many qualities that we have, eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. But our greatest quality is the power to think. As I said, man is a rational animal. So that's why we're called manusya, actually, because this is our most important or prominent characteristic that separates us from the rest of nature. So Manu, his job is to establish the code. We know the Manu Samhita. He tells us how to live, and we're supposed to follow those, or at least in principle. Of course, they are given at a certain time, and as time passes, many of them become irrelevant, but the principles are there for how human society should live. So this is dharma. The codes of dharma are established by Manvantara. So this is the idea behind this word Manvantara. We hear about dharma, but we also hear literally about the changes of the manus. Especially at the beginning of the 8th chapter, there's a kind of a review. Because you've already spoken about descendants of Swayambhuva Manu. Can you speak more about future manus, what's coming up, and something about them? So we hear about the Manvantaras, how they're, with each change of manu, there are certain posts within the universe that get changed. For example, there is a different Indra for every Manvantara. That's why Bali Maharaj will be the Indra in the next Manvantara. And we heard how what was his name? Matsya incarnation? Satyavrata? King Satyavrata. He became Vaivaswata Manu in the next Manvantara. He's our current Manu. So that's also described in the Bhagavatam, this changing of the Manus. And a lot of the Bhagavatam, especially beginning in the third chapter, third canto, it's the structure of it is genealogy, and a lot of that is tied into the Manu, especially Swayambhuva Manu. And then we hear later about Vaivaswata Manu, because that's a current Manu. So that's part of the structure of how the Bhagavatam unfolds. The next one is Ishanukata. Of course, that's very important. What is Isha Kata? That means Krishna Kata. Ishanukata. When the sages at Naimisharanya asked their questions in the first canto, one of the things they asked was, please tell us about the incarnations of the Lord. Sutta Goswami, of course, in the third chapter of the first canto, he gives a list of the avatars, and also Lord Brahma does when he speaks to Narada Muni in the seventh chapter of the second canto. So we get this Ishanukata. And then throughout the Bhagavatam, of course, we hear different incarnations. That also comes often in the course of a genealogy, that this person begat this person, that was this son, and so on. And then an incarnation of the Lord appeared from the womb of this person. Then we hear about that, the activities of that. Often the Pariksha Maharaj will ask, oh, can you say more about this person you just mentioned, this avatar? So then we hear a whole story will unfold in the Bhagavatam. So this is Ishanukata. And then Nirodha. Now, the way Prabhupada translates it here is interesting. It's not the way it's usually translated. He says Nirodha means going back home, back to Godhead. Nirodha means a destruction. We have creation, maintenance, and destruction. So Nirodha is the destruction of the universe. Now, in one sense, I'd say, well, you can say going back home, back to Godhead, because as I mentioned earlier, what happens at the time of destruction is all the jivas, they merge back into the body of the Lord. So you can say that's sort of like going back home, back to Godhead, temporarily merging into the Lord. So that's the way Prabhupada refers to it. But so again, while the jivas are merged into the Lord, after this annihilation, and there are also different kinds of annihilation that are described. This is the final annihilation. Of course, it happens at the end of Brahma's, every day of Brahma, it happens, there's an annihilation. And then there's full annihilation at the end when everything comes back into the body of Mahavishnu. Actually, everything unfolds, it goes out, it evolves from Mahavishnu. Then at the end, we have the reverse process. You may hear, for example, the yogis, they do this. This is described in a couple of places in the Bhagavatam, how he merged his senses, you know, his this sense of sight was merged into this, and then, you know, the sound we hear going back. Everything is brought back in. So everything is also brought back in to the body of Mahavishnu. That's the final Nirodha, final devastation. So the next of the ten is Mukti, liberation. Prabhupada translates, of course, that's what the word means, literally. It just means liberation. We have Mukti and Moksha, these two words we hear throughout the Bhagavatam, very common words. But then we have the definition that I said later. Mukti is really when you realize your swarup. That's the real liberation. Then finally, the Samambonam. Samambonam means the absolute truth. So the first nine. So then the second verse today says, to indicate the transcendence of the Samambonam, the symptoms of the rest are described. Sometimes by Vedic inference, sometimes by direct explanation, and sometimes by summary explanations given by great sages. Jiva Goswami does something interesting in analyzing this verse, because he quotes the 10 subjects, and then he speaks about some of these other ones too, in his Tattva-sandarbha. This is a common thing that we hear in our acharyas, Jiva Goswami and Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur also. They imply or infer questions in the dialogue that's taking place. And that, so they'll say, well, Shukadeva Goswami said this because he's thinking that, or Pariksha Maharaj is saying this or asking this question because he's thinking about something that Shukadeva may not have said, or Shukadeva is answering a question that Pariksha didn't necessarily ask, but he's thinking that Pariksha Maharaj might be thinking this way. So this often comes out in the commentaries. And throughout the 10th canto, Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur does this a lot. So this is the idea here. He says, to isolate the transcendence of the Samambonam, the symptoms of the rest are described. So he's thinking that the hearer may be thinking, well, I don't see that in the Bhagavatam, that these things have been described. Where are they described? How are they described? So that's why he's saying here, sometimes by Vedic inference. So here we have the word inference. What does inference mean? It means it's not stated directly, but you infer. There's an implication. These two words that get mixed up in English, imply and infer. So implication is what's coming from the other side. Infer is what we take. We make an inference from what is being implied by some statement. So sometimes we have to see what is being implied here. What inference can I take from being? And this, I think, sometimes devotees may mistake as speculation. But unless we do some inference, things aren't spelled out exactly. I think that sometimes, especially, for example, in how we understand karma, how karma works, it's really intricate how karma works. And there are a lot of questions that come up. And oftentimes, if you know, devotees will ask questions about it, someone will answer. And I'll think, well, there's no verse that actually says this exactly. Sometimes we say, this is my understanding, right? This is my understanding. I don't want to speculate, but this is my understanding. So that's inference. We do that all the time. We may not even realize that we're doing it. And it's not, we may want a verse that says it directly, but a lot of times it doesn't. So this is the idea here. These things are described sometimes by Vedic inference. They're being implied, sometimes by direct explanation, sometimes these things are spoken up directly, and sometimes by summary explanations given by the great sages. So throughout the Bhagavatam, of course, we have, and Jiva Goswami says, this is specifically referring to the speakers of the Bhagavatam, when it says here summary explanations by great sages, it means the great sages who were speaking, like Vidura and Maitreya. Maitreya is speaking to Vidura. And Kapiladeva, if you take him as a sage, then he's speaking directly about many of these things. So I just wanted to mention that. And then again, as coming up, verses that are coming up, there's just going to be a line or two about each of these things. And then in text 8, we hear about this idea of the adhyatmic, adhidaivic, and adhibhautik, which is a very difficult subject. It's interesting that it's tied into this. I'm going to have to read more Jiva Goswami to help myself understand it, because he discusses this also. But that's how this chapter will begin to unfold. And he'll talk about some of the creation, what is taking place in the creation later in this chapter. So that's a little something, a little overview of these 10 subjects that the Bhagavatam discusses, all these ten topics of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So the chapter, interesting, is titled, Bhagavatam is the answer to all questions. So these 10 subjects, they encapsulate everything we need to know. All the subordinate characteristics, or the tatashta shakti, tatashta lakshana of the tattva, and of course, now the other thing is people may know something of some of these things, even in other religious traditions, but they don't know really the ashraya. Directly the ashraya, Bhagavan. They don't know Bhagavan. They may have some hint of the creator even, but Bhagavan, the person at home, they don't know. Nobody knows Krishna. And of course, when we say this is God, they say, what? How can that be God? How can that little boy create all of this? But that's ashraya. That's the ultimate ashraya. Bhagavan. Everything comes from that little boy. He's the ashraya. All right. Anything? Questions? Comments?
And Jesus said, "I cannot tell you of my Father, for you would not understand."
Yeah. Or Gautama Buddha.
I don't see the difference between Ishanukata, the science of God, and Samam Bonam. You said Samam Bonam.
Well, Ishanukata is really about the avatars.
Oh.
And Samam Bonam means Bhagavan.
And where does it sounds like Samam Bonam is a Latin word.
Yeah, it is.
Where is that? Oh, it is.
It is a Latin word.
And it means the ultimate good or something?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Ultimate good literally is what it means. Or the highest good.
Very good. So the Manus, their personalities, like Bhagavatam describes Swayambhuva Manu, he was residing at Brahmavarta, which is northern India. But so the current Manu, Vaivasvata, yeah. I mean, he's a person also. He's supposed to be residing, I guess, somewhere on the earth planet also. You know, and he's supposed to be residing at least for the whole Manvantara, which is over 300 million years.
But what he teaches comes to us through parampara. That's the way it works. We can't see him. Yeah, it's interesting. And a lot of times things take place in the Bhagavatam. I say, where did this happen? It's hard to tell a lot of the times. And of course, so a lot of the stories, there was in previous times, the demigods would come to Earth and interact with human beings directly. And it does seem there, Aryavarta, it says that that's where Manu lived, which that's usually North India, basically, is usually called. Between the Himalayas and the Vindhya Hills, that's called Aryavarta. And it says directly in the Bhagavatam that that's where at least Swayambhuva Manu was living. So it seems like he's living on Earth, and maybe the other It doesn't necessarily say for all of them where they're living, but it's like Vyasadeva. We hear that Vyasadeva is still living in the Himalayas, but we can't see him. Madhvacharya could, but we can't. So Manu, another interesting thing is that, you know, in each manvantara, there's a particular incarnation of the Lord. Those are listed in the Bhagavatam. So the current manvantara avatar is Vamanadeva. And it's said that Manu has direct access to the manvantara avatar. So Manu can communicate directly with Lord Vamanadeva. So his dharma, he gets his dharma directly from him, from the manvantara avatar. Prangavinda Prabhu?
I was thinking the word Nirodha, that destruction, or you can say, Prabhupada says going back home, back to Godhead. It can be applied, because I was thinking 12 Kanto, chapter 4 and 7, both has that word I saw. And I remember there's four types of inhalation. Every jiva taking birth and dying, that's one kind of inhalation. Then every day of Brahma, then end of Brahma's life. But the fourth type of inhalation is actually going back home, back to Godhead. It's not an inhalation, even though it is inhalation. The dissolving the subtle body, the existence of material. So from that angle, proper translation is perfect.
Yeah, actually, I was going to look this up. See how it comes up in the word, in the upcoming verses. Pungsam is, oh, must come before that. Avataran, let's see, Nirodho, oh, Mukti, okay. Prabhupada translates it here in text 6, Nirodho Asyanu Shayanam. The merging of the living entity along with his conditional living tendency with the mystic lying down of the Mahavishnu is called the winding up of the cosmic manifestation. So that's the way Prabhupada translates it later, which is what I was referring to, the end of, you know, the annihilation. So he defines it in both ways, once in this one, in this verse, and then later when it comes up, he translates it more as it's usually the way that it's spoken of, this merging of the material creation back into Mahavishnu along with the jiva. That's usually how this Nirodha is taken.
I was thinking like...
Prabhupada would like to talk about going back to Godhead.
I was thinking like, if for the sake of argument, like, since we are coming from the Mahavishnus, so going back home could be Mahavishnu. Not necessarily Golok Vrindavan. Because Jivanama Tadastaka Ekashakti.
Yeah, well, that's what I said. Yeah, I said that's kind of like going back to God because you're going back into Mahavishnu. But that's usually not what we think, though.
Correct.
We think of going to Krishna or Vaikuntha out of this material world completely, forever. Yes, Sri Vrindavan Prabhu.
Hare Krishna Prabhuji. I was wondering, how do we understand that Mahavishnu, he creates sound, form, taste, smell, touch. By their one thing, those are five, and then eyes, ears, nose, skin and mind, those are separate. So how is it he creates those things? What is the meaning of taste if we don't have a tongue or something to taste with? So how can we differentiate and how do we understand that?
I don't know. Somehow these things exist as parts of nature alone. And, they're called, just like they're called, the sense objects are called tanmatras. The word matra means alone, actually. That's actually what the word means. Tanmatra means those things alone. So it means that these objects of the senses, sound, it exists, of course, as an element of nature, and not any particular sound, but sound itself as a tattva, tanmatra. So sound, form. So you think, well, how can you think of form without something having that form? Right? That's really what your question is. But somehow that's the idea. This is especially in the third canto, this is discussed. In Maitreya speaking to Vidura, he talks about the creation, and he talks about the creation of these elements and how they were all dormant until consciousness entered into this Virat Rupa. This is also, these things are considered to be part of the Virat Rupa, the universal form of the Lord. So they're all constituents of this material world, and in some sense they, you know, they exist as separate entities. That's the right word, but somehow they exist, you know, because they're part of the, you know, they're listed as elements of the material creation. So, you know, it's hard to understand what, you know, what these things can be without, you know, how can you have sight without seeing anything, and so on. There's even talk, Jiva Goswami, or discussing the jiva, how there can be, you know, consciousness without consciousness of anything, because we always think, well, I'm conscious of something. But there's contentless consciousness, which is another, you know, mind-bending idea. So this is the, these things are very subtle, I don't know. Maybe yogis, if you become a yogi, you can have some perception of these very subtle aspects of material nature. We know that there are so many subtleties that yogis can penetrate. They're very mysterious. And apparently they do, because when they you know, when they give up their body by their own will, how we hear this process of withdrawing everything, so they understand some subtle aspects of how nature works in a very subtle way, and they're able to manipulate these things. That's another explanation of how they're actually existing as real entities, because the yogis can manipulate them. So it has to be a thing, some kind of thing that exists on its own. And the yogis are, they know how to work them. That's why, one reason they can do so, I mean, they have mystic powers, they can work with these things. Whereas to us, it's beyond our imagination. Even our conception, we can't, it's hard for us to understand even in theory what these things are.
How do we make sure that our inferences aren't mental speculation? Like, how do we infer without speculating? And how do we validate that the inferences we're making are actually helping our devotional service and not drawing us off the path?
Well, we have three basic authorities, sadhu, shastra, and guru. So we have to consult these. And actually, we always do that. We always, even, you know, throughout, even we're so-called advanced devotees, we confer with others. And we don't speculate. We try to get some support. We have some idea. Is there shastric evidence to support this, whether directly or indirectly? Again, as we were reading in this verse here, these things are spoken of directly, sometimes indirectly. In fact, Krishna says, this is called parokshavad. Krishna likes to keep things hidden, especially things about himself. So he speaks in mysterious ways, indirectly about things. So you have to work at it. We have to work at purifying ourselves, too, purifying our consciousness. Ultimately, purity is what's required. Then we can perceive subtle things, and even understanding philosophy, and there are many subtleties of our philosophy. So it takes some time, and especially, you know, early beginning days, which we're all in our beginning days, no matter how many decades we've been around, we consult with others and we constantly hear. You know, I find, one thing I find interesting is that, because I like to read, like, Jiva Goswami, the Sandarbhas, I like to study them, Vishwanath's commentaries, Jiva Goswami's commentaries, especially when I'm trying to understand a verse. But one thing I've discovered is that sometimes I'll read something and I'll say, oh, I learned this from Jiva Goswami. Then I'll read Prabhupada's books and I'll say, oh, there it is, right there in the first canto. How many times have I read this? But and I'm thinking that I learned it from Jiva Goswami, but actually I should have learned it from Prabhupada, because Prabhupada already said the same thing. So Prabhupada has actually taught us so many things. He has passed on You know, there may be certain, you know, little details here and there, but so many essential things Prabhupada has taught to us. So we have to read Prabhupada's books constantly, over and over again. Then we get, you know, intuition, you might say, to understand things a little deeper, you know, because there's so much depth in our philosophy. So if we think one thing and everybody else is saying something else, that's not... That's a clue that maybe our understanding is not correct. So we get guidance again in this way, sadhu, shastra, and guru. Sadhu means the parampara, coming down in parampara. Especially for us, we have Lord Chaitanya and everyone coming in our line, these great devotees in our line, so many great commentators on the Bhagavatam, and especially our most recent ones before Prabhupada, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Their contributions are immense in helping us understand the teaching of the previous acharyas. So all of this, we can take help from all of them. Prabhupada talks about these things in his books, reading. Sometimes he will say, one should, you know, what is it? Is it the Brihad Bhagavatamrita? One book, maybe that is. One cannot understand Krishna without reading this book. He makes statements like that. You know. There's so many ways we have of enlightening ourselves and understanding, broadening our understanding of so many topics that are brought out. I think it's Brihad Bhagavatamrita. Does anybody know for sure?
Yeah.
I think Prabhupada says that. One cannot understand Krishna without reading this book. So of course Prabhupada is glorifying Sanatana Goswami. Part of it, you say it's his ecstasy. He sometimes says these. Prabhupada says a lot of, you might say, things in a superlative. He uses the word immediately a lot. And you read it and you think, I don't know about immediately. 40, 50 years later, I'm still waiting for that immediately to happen. But, you know, Prabhupada, his bhava, his ecstasy, his enthusiasm. So he sometimes say things like that. Or greatest, the greatest devotee. How many people are the greatest devotee? Yes, Raghat Mugapuru. Okay, this is the final. I don't like going over time.
Who is the greatest devotee?
Vaishnava Mita Shambhu, Lord Shiva. So you could argue. But you think Shiva is a greater devotee than Radharani? So Shiva's the greatest devotee, but I think Radharani is the greatest devotee.
How is the word samam bonam used before Srila Prabhupada using it?
In other words, how did whoever used it,
out there,
Thomas Aquinas or I don't know.
Referring to God then, something like that? Or
maybe they use it when they're discussing, you know, Aristotle or Plato or those people. Because they were interested in the ultimate good. That's what they were looking for.
Oh, okay.
What is that ultimate good? So in philosophy, it may be used in that. I suspect it was used in philosophy in that way. That's what the philosophers were looking for, the summum bonum. What is it? We would say Brahman, you know, atato brahma jigyasa. So atato summum bonum jigyasa is, you might say, another way of phrasing it. What is the ultimate? What is the ultimate truth, the absolute truth? Summum bonum holds everything together. All right, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.